With me now live on Fresh Air for a return visit is poet and novelist Marge Piercy, whose writing is frequently about feminism and leftist organizing. Her latest novel, Fly Away Home, is about an upper-middle-class woman named Daria, who is a successful cookbook author. Her husband is a lawyer. Her daughters are teenagers. Fly Away Home opens at the end of Daria's book tour. Well, I think I'll let you talk about this, Marge Piercy, who will do a reading in just a moment. Marge Piercy's other novels include Braided Lives, Vita, Woman on the Edge of Time, and Small Changes. She will, by the way, appear at two book signings in Philadelphia this evening from 6:30 to 7:30. She'll give a reading and book signing at the House of Our Own Well-Read Bookroom at 3920 Spruce Street. At 8:15, she'll hold a book signing at Giovanni's Room on 12th and Pine Streets. By the way, that book signing time has been changed. It had been initially scheduled for earlier. So note that the time now at Giovanni's this evening is 8:15, and that's at 12th and Pine Streets. Marge Piercy, welcome back to Fresh Air. And before we describe the story of the book, perhaps you can read the opening passage from it.
Like many women, Daria both loved her mother and prayed not to become her. Often Daria felt helpless before her mother Nina's woes, yet her first impulse was to reassure herself, I am different. I have a good and faithful husband. I have my own work. I live in a beautiful house. I like my life. Misery was not hereditary or contagious. Since the plane had taken off late from Chicago, Daria had been dividing her time between worrying about her younger daughter Tracy, who'd gone away to college for the first time, and Nina, who had sounded more depressed and lonely than usual on the plane last night, on the phone last night. Was Nina really sick or just unhappy? Gray murk enclosed the plane, clouds on which it bumped and slipped and veered as if bouncing over a shifting sea of children's marbles. Daria felt a little sick. 4:30 on a Friday, Boston's Logan Airport was embroiled in its customary traffic jam. On the invisible ground, hidden in some random direction, cars would be backed up through the Callahan Tunnel, while here in the lumpy air, planes circled like blind boxes. Daria had a fatigue headache. For 10 days she'd been rushing through 7 cities. She'd been kept up past midnight, then forced to rise at 5:30 for morning television shows, or to catch early planes to other cities. Everywhere she had put on exhibitions to plug her cookbook in an unfamiliar studio with no rehearsal, no backup, no repeats, and a technical staff she'd never seen before. In the canvas bag wedged under the seat in front of her was that minimal equipment she needed for the 2 to 4 minutes she was given. Still, once she was on camera or in front of a crowd, she got excited and involved no matter how many times she'd given the same spiel. Since studios and department stores generally lack stoves, she cut up local vegetables, showing how to slice and display crudités for hors d'oeuvres or a first course with her patter. People always feel virtuous when they eat raw veggies. It's almost as if they're dieting by eating. You have them in a good mood, especially if you want to serve something more fattening, such as a delicious pasta next. The knife and honing block, the platters, the spices for dip, all had to accompany her on the plane, because at least once every tour her luggage went off to Juneau when she was heading for Houston. There was usually that little scene at the metal detector when her knife went through, and sometimes the pouch was taken by the flight attendant to landing. Her carry-on luggage always rattled in spite of how well she packed the platters. She was an old pro. Her index finger was still infected from the cut she'd given herself on camera in Atlanta, but she simply carried on smiling. Demonstrating with flash was fun, even the 28th time. Closing her eyes against the dismal cabin, she saw Ross's face. She'd not been able to reach him the night before, but finally she'd caught him in his law office while she was waiting and waiting to board the plane at O'Hare. She missed him, a raw, loose feeling in her. They'd married so young they'd formed each other. She'd come to him not fully human, a fish girl, half jelly and half bones. He had been raw, bright, idealistic, and entirely unsure of himself, spiny as a sea urchin, shy as a feral cat. Home, please, home, she bade, concentrating on the murk in the plane. Slowly she spun her wedding ring round and round on her finger, as if rubbing a lamp that could emit a genie. Somewhere under the gray sludge, Ross was waiting, watching the clock. Maybe Robin, their older daughter, would be with him. Tomorrow was Daria's 43rd birthday. She discharged her last obligation to promote the new book, except for cooking schools and demonstrations around Boston. Did the engine sound funny? She got herself breathing through her mouth like Tort, their dog, when he was scared. The day after her birthday, she could go back to work on the new cookbook. That would be paradise, to be home, her place, her peace, her husband, alone for the first time since Robin had been born. She would talk to Ross about bringing Nina north for a visit, even if Pops wouldn't come. That would cheer Nina up, seeing her children and grandchildren. She'd call the night and make sure Tracy was coming home for the weekend. Suddenly the sound of the engines changed as the flight attendant rapidly recited that landing litany, "Make sure your tray tables are upright." Daria hugged herself, glancing around her seat for stray items. Home. Her stomach was stripped raw, her complexion mottled with poor food. She had suffered from bad dreams. But almost immediately she was being returned to Ross, her love, and things would be better between them. He would have missed her. Now things would be just fine.
It's Marge Piercy reading the opening of her new book, Fly Away Home. Can you give us a kind of capsule of the novel?
Well, in its genre, I think it may actually be a new genre. It's a divorce mystery. That is the sense that Daria has when she comes home of something being wrong, which is denied by Ross, but which finally is not deniable, leads her on a quest, which is partly the quest to understand why her marriage is falling and then has fallen apart, partly the effort to understand who he has become, because she begins to realize that the intimacy of their marriage has basically been phased out in its place as a relationship which is centered around their children, and their youngest daughter has just left home, has centered around her being the famous chef who makes fancy dinner parties for him while he entertains clients he wants to impress. It's become a matter of, was the oil delivered? Did you arrange for this? Did you arrange for that? And she doesn't even really know him anymore. She doesn't know who he is. The center of his life is no longer in the house. The center of his life is not even in the law practice, she imagines, but in a set of real estate manipulations she isn't even aware he's engaged in. And she pursues that quest for knowledge because, like many divorced women, she is forced to come to understand a lot of things she has never understood or never taken control of in her life.
The novel is in some ways about class, because she's very comfortable and has a wonderful home and family, and her home is soon being picketed by people. Am I giving too much away here?
No, I think that's fine. That's the first sign she has. There's little things. There's little things that don't mesh. There are little mysteries that come out of that hidden life of Ross's, which she doesn't understand. A package that stinks. I mean, it has a dead rat in it, but she doesn't know what's in it. Being sent by some of his tenants. Accusations about the death of a little boy, Bobby Rosario, that died in a fire. And why do they talk to Ross about that? I mean, if he was run over, would they picket somebody? I mean, she doesn't understand. And all these little things begin coming in, little clues to this other life of his.
Which is as a slumlord.
He's gentrifying.
Gentrifying,
I mean,
yeah.
It's not a slum. See, the house, the first piece of arson that he engaged in, as you go back historically in the book, and when she goes back to East Boston, where she comes from, see, she comes from the working class. When she goes back to East Boston, the house that had been her parents' house, which then, after the money had been raised by all the kids and her husband to send the parents down to Florida where they wanted to live, that house had been rented for quite a while and then burned. And this has never been real to her, because she's never seen it since it was burned, until she goes back to East Boston, which she used to visit twice a week and hasn't visited in years. And now that is a case where there's a type of arson that goes on In neighborhoods where the insurance becomes worth more than the property, or instant parking lot, which is what they use it for, a parking lot, is worth more than they can gouge in rents out of anything they can get the tenants to pay. But there's other neighborhoods, such as the one that she comes to know, which he's very active in. No, it's not a slum. It's a neighborhood where there's some affluent people live and some working class people and a lot of people in between. But it has a potentiality for being turned into a very upscale neighborhood. That is Ross feels so. And he needs a little help in gentrifying it. He has to get the tenants out.
Do you know any people who, like Ross, have kind of slowly slid into being an exploiter, someone who had ideals, who really meant to do well, and slowly starts using people and actually really hurting people?
I think yes. I think I've seen that quite a bit. I think the first time I saw that was sort of the early days of sort of hip capitalism, when you saw, in fact, a number of people moving into the media. I'm sure you've encountered them. Who had good intentions to begin with, but very quickly got rid of them. I think there's a lot of people like that. He would not say he let go of his ideals. If the novel was from Ross's point of view, it would have nothing to do with arson, because it's a very minor part of his doing business. It's just one of those little expenses. It would be a lot about how he'd come to sensitivity and how he'd come into a new understanding of himself, and about how he'd come into his adult responsibility as a man toward the city, and how he was sculpting the city.
So that leads me to believe that you really don't buy a lot of the arguments for gentrification that are presented by business people. Who want to build up the city and create a better tax base and business base, because that's certainly something that's happening in Philadelphia. Do you distrust the kind of building up?
I distrust the way it's sometimes done.
Mm-hmm.
The uses, the way in which people are gotten out who happen to be there. I think that you can have a very mixed neighborhood that's very pleasant, where building by building, in fact, you get a mixed class neighborhood, and I think they're often more viable, but that frequently will not do for developers, because then all the land becomes potentially valuable and potentially gentrifiable. Where there's a toleration for a mixed use, then oftentimes you get an interesting neighborhood that's nicer for everybody who lives in it.
What kind of research did you do for the book?
Some of the research was research in divorce law, precisely, and, you know, the economics of divorce, which I think divorce is the time a lot of women learn about finance. And Daria does learn about finance the hard way in fighting through the acrimonious divorce. Then there was the research about arson. Now, I'd been clipping about arson for, years and years and years. I'm always clipping on subjects that interested me. I got interested in arson because I lived in a neighborhood in New York where there were an enormous number, in Brooklyn actually, where there were an enormous number of fires, and it became real clear after a while that they were a number of them being set to empty buildings. And that was a case like East Boston arson, where it was being done for the insurance money and the buildings would just stand there afterwards. But anyhow, I got I started clipping about arson then. And over the years, I'd accumulated a lot of material. But I did a lot of research even at the time, because there was a lot of technical stuff you don't learn from newspapers. There was this book I remember I was carrying around at one point, which was this textbook for arson investigators. And I was traveling at the time I was reading it, and I have never seen people move away from me so much. It was fantastic. I'd sit and read it. I was stuck in O'Hare, I remember, waiting for flights. And O'Hare's an airport where people sometimes bother you for some reason. You know, men will bother you in O'Hare. Well, they'd see that. They'd sit down next to me, they'd see that book, and they'd get up and they'd go away. There was something about that. A textbook for arson investigators. It absolutely was a turnout. It was wonderful. I've often thought of carrying it around since then.
When you want privacy.
Yeah. But then several people helped me. I mean, there's always people who are interested, you know, in any aspect of politics. And I give credit in the beginning of the book to Annie Waterflow, who was an organizer in a tennis group called STOP that had indeed managed to slow down arson in their neighborhood, where it was just incredible, the amount of arson going on in that neighborhood. A number of people were killed. She taught me how to do the research, as Sandra Maria teaches Daria in the novel. And Mark Sanger of the Boston Herald American knows a lot about arson, too. And he's full of tales and wonderful anecdotes, and he's a long political memory. And he was very interesting to talk to. He was very helpful.
March Piercy is my guest, and her latest novel is called Fly Away Home. There's a lot of food imagery in the book, in part because Daria writes cookbooks, but also her daughter's kind of anorexic.
And yeah, Robin is.
And her husband calls cookbooks fat books, and he wants her to lose weight. I'm sure you've given a lot of thought to the obsession with thinness that we're undergoing now in America. Do you have any explanation for it?
I think it's a hatred of flesh. Flesh is evil, and it's a hatred of women. Women are fleshy in many ways in our essence. I think basic female body has breasts and, you know, thighs and a belly. And the fear of, for instance, you're not supposed to have a belly. Now, a belly was thought beautiful for most of the time that history has existed. The image of deity for most of the time there's been people was that of a mature female body. The goddess was always a big-bodied woman. I think it's, you know, hatred of femininity. I mean, if you want to get anywhere, you're supposed to look like a man. You're supposed to dress like a man, or you're supposed to dress like a woman, but not a woman with a body. It's sort of décolleté with no tits, sort of that you're talking about. You see what I mean? I mean, it sort of like says, take me, but you can't really have me. There's something going on there which is really strange, and I'm not real. I'm plastic, and I won't age. And I will be forever like a little girl. It's part and parcel. It's both the boy as sexual image, and also the little girl who's undemanding and passive, and you can do anything to her, and she isn't strong enough to fight you.
Huh.
Which goes along with all the child molesting of which our society seems so inordinately fond and seems to promote.
Do you find that popular imagery like that affects your own sensibility even though you don't buy it?
Have you ever seen Gene Kilbourne's slideshow?
No.
My now chapter had her in to do her slideshow on advertising, and I am convinced it affects all of us. Our images of attractiveness and self-worth and so forth. After all, one time, I don't remember why, I started noticing just nude bodies of women displayed in streets and every place. I don't know why. Just one time I was walking around Boston and I just started noticing how the bodies of women were used decoratively and not the bodies of men. And it was therefore objects and parts of bodies. And I just started noticing this one day, and you become sensitized to it and you realize it's the message being delivered to you all the time. About the objectification parts of your body.
Do you try to deprogram yourself when you think it's being programmed into you?
Yeah. I mean, don't we all fight against it? By trying to have a positive self-image as a woman I'm 47 years old. And I like myself, and I like my body, and I want to go on liking it, and I don't want the society to persuade me that I should be ashamed of my age or my body.
In your book, you write, like many women, Daria both loved her mother and let me read that again. Like many women, Daria both loved her mother and prayed not to become her. And I thought, gee, that must be something a lot of women go through. Can you explain what you were thinking of when you wrote that?
Exactly what I said. I don't think if I could have said it better, yeah. I would have said it better. I worked on that sentence a long time to say exactly what I meant, and I do mean that there is I think that we have to find to find the love of our mothers, which some of us have lost at times, and to reclaim it, but also not to want to repeat the life. For many of us, our mothers were the life, the unlived life, the unused talents, the unused energies, a sense of constrainment, waste, hunger on many levels.
How did you feel if, I don't know if this happened to you, when people would come up to you and say that you looked a lot like your mother?
I think I was always rather pleased because I thought my mother was beautiful. I don't think that ever displeased me. There was one point when my mother became incredibly fat. It was a protest against something in her life. And I felt bad then because I felt as if she was lost inside all of that excess weight. It was like it was hard for her to get around, then hard for her to walk. And then toward the end, then she returned to herself again. I felt as if, in some way, I felt she was lost. Not that she was ever a thin woman, though she was at the very end. But it was as if somehow her own body got lost and she couldn't run anymore. And it was anger then.
You have a passage about the death of Daria's mother. I'd like you to read that for us, if you would.
I'd love to. I'm going to have to rattle for a moment.
While you're rattling, I'll mention that again, the title of the book that Marge Piercy is about to read from. It's her new novel, Fly Away Home.
You know, it's a children's rhyme. Lady Bird, fly away home. Your house is on fire, your children will burn. Actually, I used to say, my mother taught me to say that as a little girl. When Daria was little, the third born after Franklin and Joe, she'd conspired, she'd striven mightily, she'd plotted to please her mother. She'd also wanted to please her father, of course, but so many things and so many people pleased Pops and were pleased by him. He was a widely social man with inner and outer circles of pals from the neighborhood, from the bar, from his various jobs. Her father was what far too many women had always called a fine figure of a man. Maybe that had made Daria fairly immune to appearance. Ross was not conventionally handsome. He had his features, his glorious red-gold hair, his intensely blue eyes. However, he moved always on the edge of awkwardness, and he had an underslung jaw. His posture was poor, and his cheeks still pitted to the touch from acne he'd barely overcome when she met him in his second-to-last year of law school. One of Daria's roommates had said something cruel about Ross. "He's so good-looking when you see him from behind, and then want to come down when he turns around." She'd been furious, protective of him. She had immediately preferred him to her more conventionally handsome boyfriends for his character, his sense of social and personal responsibility. She'd learned from watching her mother's troubles, her mother who had married the tall, dark, handsome corner boy. Yet Nina's approval was the hope she could not kill off, the fantasy she could not quite resist, that Nina would turn and say to her at last, "Daria, what you've made of yourself! What a good daughter! What a good mother! What a good wife! And people respect you, all those books, your name in the papers." She had the intermittent fantasy on the plane that when she was standing beside Nina in the intensive care unit, she would penetrate the fog of the stroke, reach with her mind into her mother's consciousness. Either she would bring Nina back to consciousness, defying them all, or she would at least say a personal farewell. She wanted to believe that still, but the scene was no longer credible to her. Joe called to her as she was waiting for her bag to appear on the carousel. "Where's Ross and the kids?" "I came down alone because I was the only one who could get away immediately." "Oh, everybody's working weekends now? They must be in my business." Joe loomed over her, the tallest of a family in which she and her mother were considered short at 5'6". If his nose had not been broken in high school and reset poorly, he would have been as handsome as Pop's. As it was, his hair was receding fast. "They sent you down alone? When are they planning to arrive?" "When I've checked out the situation, I'll call them." "You get on the phone right away and tell them to move their butts down here." 5 minutes in her company, and as usual, he was issuing orders, trying to bully her. Tracy's in college and Robin has a new job at John Hancock. Ross can't just fly off whenever he pleases. She tried to sound calm and confident. So how is Mama? If you wouldn't mind letting me know. She grabbed her suitcase as it rode past. He took it from her and carried it out to a station wagon, double parked outside with his oldest kid, Junior, at the wheel. Did you eat? He asked, bumping Junior over. Daria climbed into the back. Not really, but it doesn't matter. He said you wouldn't eat the crap on the airplane. He's waiting for you at the hospital. He said with emphasis, and her family always meant Pops, I'm not hungry, I want to see her. Sure, not that there's much to see. She's got a nice nurse. It's a real modern hospital, first rate, all the new gadgets, every room a private room. Nice for Mama. A quality place. So tell me, Mama, how is she? She's in a coma. They did an EEG on her this morning, and it was flat, two flat readings in a row, and they shut off the respirator. Why? Because that means she's dead. They could make a mistake. Everybody makes mistakes. Daria, you're being silly. They handle strokes every day. There's six other stroke victims in there right now. How far is it? Another half hour, relax. You'll see her plenty of time. Then you and him eat at the Lobster. He must be starving. He hasn't had a bite since lunch. Joe had moved his family to Florida a few years after their parents retired there. The restaurants he had owned in Revere had done poorly. After a fire, Joe had given up on Revere and moved his family south on the insurance money, where they opened a restaurant in a shopping plaza, two towns away from where Nina and Pops were living. When she entered the hospital room, she was astonished at the small heap Nina made under the hospital linens. Nina had been a plump woman most of her life, but now she was girlishly slender. Daria took Nina's cool, papery hand. The respirator made its horrid sound while glucose hung down in a bag onto Nina's limp arm. Pops rose from a chair by the window and came to embrace Daria. He looked well, tanned, unlike most old men she saw around the hospital. Unlike Nina, who was as pallid as if she'd spent the year up north. He had his full bushy head of black hair streaked with snow. Now he'd grown a pepper and salt mustache with longer sideburns. He pinched her cheek, calling her Dolly, as he had pet names for every one of his children, drawing her into a massive hug against his paunch. The nurse was adjusting the machine as Daria moved close to take her mother's hand again. She pressed gently. Nothing. They took another EEG. Flat, stone flat, Joe was explaining. You should say goodbye to her, and then we should take Pops to supper. I was waiting for you, Pops said. Sad thing. There was nothing they could do for her, but she didn't suffer none. We can be glad for that. It hit her like a bolt of lightning, and that was it. What's going to happen? She wriggled between her father and Joe to address the nurse. Daria was 43 with her own family and a career. How could her family make her immediately 11, awkward, and a misfit? The EEGs measure whether her brain is still functioning, you understand? Whether it's still on, if you follow me. The nurse avoided her gaze. We can start a heart again, and we can put a patient on a kidney machine, but once the brain is turned off, that's it. Legally, that's death in this state. Suppose the machine isn't working. It's functional. It's working on the other patients. That's why we do it twice to be sure, dear. She didn't suffer. She never knew what hit her. During those 2 hours or more lying on the floor, Daria thought she didn't know. You were with her all day? I come in for the evening shift. I kept talking to her last night because naturally I always do that just in case the poor dears can hear, even if the doctors say they can't. Why take a chance? Nobody really knows. I'm glad you talked to her, thank you. That's what I'm here for. Go ahead, you can talk to her if you want to. She stepped close to the narrow bed. Nina looked asleep. It was hard to believe she could not be awakened. That was still Nina there, palpably. She bent over to kiss her mother's forehead. It's me, Daria, your daughter, she said. The presence of the others inhibited her. Mama, it's me. Daria, come down to be with you. Gently she laid her cheek on Nina's breast. When she finally let go of Nina, the men were waiting in the corridor. The nurse said, Your father's such a wonderful man, such a lively gentleman. He doesn't miss a thing. What's going to be done now? Exactly what? We turn off the respirator. That's all that's keeping her body going. Her own breathing has stopped. The nurse drew her aside, lowering her voice. Why, Daria wondered, because only Nina was there to overhear. Dear, it's only a matter of time, a short time, even if your father hadn't decided. She's only on the respirator. Either her heart or her kidneys will malfunction over the next 2 days. It'll be uremia or heart failure. Her pressure's critically low. You can let her lie there on the respirator till her kidneys fail, but she can't come back. She had a fierce and irrational desire to force them to leave the machine going, but as she clutched again at Nina's limp, chilly hand, she knew she was wrong. Nina was no longer present. Daria also knew she had no power here. She was only a daughter. Decisions were being made by Pops as usual, and any he left unmade, Joe would clean up. Nonetheless, the sleeper was Nina, still some kind of mother. She did not want to give her up. Surely her lashes were lightly quivering. She did not want to leave. Come on, Daria. Visiting hours are over. Joe took her arm and dragged her away.
Thanks for reading that. That's Marge Piercy reading a passage from her new novel, Fly Away Home. Can I ask you what you've been thinking about recently in terms of the nuclear family? Because there's, I think, so much ambivalence in this book, for instance, about the family. And, I mean, there's, after all, divorce that happens within it. In that scene, here's someone who's being treated as she's powerless, even though she's a very intelligent, middle-aged woman, powerless because she's the daughter. Yet she feels so strongly for her mother. Do you see nuclear families working around you? Because I'm thinking, too, that a lot of people who, for almost political reasons, left the nuclear family and tried different alternatives like communes and things like that, have many of them returned to the nuclear family with a very romantic view of the family.
I don't have a romantic view of the family. I think that there's little else one can do at this point. I'm living monogamously, and that's nice now. It's the first time I've done it in 20 years, and it's a good relationship. But I think that to do anything else at this point in time requires an immense amount of effort, and that isn't my political priority right now. I mean, it's not what I'm most scared of. And I think that when things are a little better again, things may loosen up. The nuclear family works if everybody in it is equally committed to nurturing. So other arrangements also work if everybody's equally committed to nurturing. If everybody isn't, none of them work.
You're living in Wellfleet now, which is on Cape Cod.
Yes.
And you have always been a political activist or involved with political issues. Are you maintaining that kind of part of your life in Wellfleet, which I think most of us who don't live on Cape Cod think of as being very remote?
Is it remote from where? The people in cities always make me laugh that way. I mean, you know, wherever you live is real. It's where you live. And the people living there are real people with, you know, sets of problems. I'm politically, I'm the legislative chair of my now chapter, which I shouldn't be because I travel too much. But I should be the assistant or vice chair. I shouldn't be the chair, but I am the chair. Nobody else is willing to do it. it's a lot of work. We have an active chapter. We brought Gene Kilburn in. Once in a while we do a radio program. We try to put out a little newsletter. We have we did something in electoral politics before that. And the next thing we're dealing with is a meeting about the issues of women and poverty and aging, which is big. They're big issues in our area.
I regret that we're just about out of time. The time has really flown. Will you be writing another novel soon? Is that
I'm writing one now, but this is going to take a while. You said you were going to ask me about
Kathy Boudin?
Yeah.
Yeah, I really wanted to know what you thought of the way that the pretrial has been going. The trial.
Yeah, the pretrial. She was tried already in the media. She's been tried in the media for 2 years on no evidence. She was tried in a book by someone who never met her. She was tried in the media. She's been tried all over the place. I mean, I think it's sort of, I think it's very unfair. The assumption. I mean, there's an assumption of guilt, an assumption of knowledge, long before any trial or any evidence has come forward, and I think it makes it very hard to get a fair trial.
Well, I sincerely wish we had more time to talk. I really want to thank you a lot for coming back to Fresh Air and for reading from Fly Away Home today for us. Thanks for being here.